Okay, I'm going to call this meeting, the House Finance Committee meeting, House Finance Committee to order, and let the record reflect that the time is currently 2:05 p.m. on Friday, April 28th, 2017. Present today, we do have Representative Ortiz, Kawasaki, Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, folks could mute their cell phones. And Representative Thompson is excused from today's meeting. And at this meeting, we'll be having our second hearing on SB 83, which is the protection of vulnerable adults and residents of long-term care facilities. If it's the will of the committee, it's my intent to move the bill today. And then after that, we will have an introductory hearing on SB 78, the Permanent Fund Dividend Contributions and Lottery Bill. And we'll also have an introductory hearing on HB 105, which is the Gordon Haber Wolf Special Management Area Bill. And we'll also be having public testimony on that. And then we'll be taking public testimony on both SB 78 and 105. So if there's nothing else, we will go ahead and jump into our first order of business, which is SB 83, the Protection of Vulnerable Adults and Residents of Long-Term Care Facilities, by the Governor. And we'll ask for this bill on April 24th. And so with that, we did not receive any amendments to this bill. So at this time, I'd like to ask Teresa Holt, Long-Term Care Ombudsman, who is on the, I believe, on the phone.
On the phone.
She's on the phone. Okay. Okay. If she could just put yourself on the record, Ms. Holt, and if you could refresh the committee on SB 83.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Teresa Holt. I'm the state long-term care ombudsman. And basically, this is a bill to bring the state into compliance with federal regulations.
Okay.
To ensure that the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman shares only resident information with informed consent, to ensure the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman can obtain records and investigate and make referrals when a resident is unable to provide informed consent, adds new terms for resident and resident representative, due to a conflict of interest, removes the option for mandatory reporters to meet reporting requirements by submitting a report to the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, clarifies the separation of the role of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, from the role of the Division of Health and Social Services, and clarifies that the long-term care ombudsman may serve residents in long-term care facilities under the age of 60. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I also want to note that we have online Kelda Barstead. She's the Health Program Manager, Division of Senior and Disability Services. So with that, are there any questions of the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I sent a question, and everybody has the response in their packet. And I guess I need a little bit more clarification. So I was asking about Section 11, AS 47-62030B, where it states, allows the state to step in when the state feels that a decision, including action or inaction, may adversely affect the health, safety, welfare of the older Alaskan. And my question was, you know, so even if an individual has a representative or a guardian, does the state somehow get more power with this bill than they currently have?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Section B is about the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman being able to make referrals and share information with other agencies that may investigate. And so Section 1 that you're talking about only allows us to share information if we feel that someone is at risk and they are not able to give us consent and or they don't have a representative, resident representative to give us consent.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So let's say they have a guardian and let's say you start looking at something and you have a concern and you still think something's going on, although they have a guardian or a representative, this would not allow you to then report it maybe to the fraud unit or somewhere else to get additional information?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we would only do that if we felt the guardian was not acting in the best interest. So in a situation where a guardian is either exploiting somebody or another situation might be where the guardian is unresponsive and there's a need that needs to be fixed, we would make a referral of the information we had for the complaint to the probate court and let the probate court deal with it.
Follow up?
Okay,
and I make sure we're talking about B, not D, but so the person, but I'm talking about the person who is responsive. I understand if somebody can't speak for themselves, that's a little bit different, but I'm talking about somebody who has decided to turn their power of attorney over because maybe they're going to get to a point where they may not be able to make it themselves. I'm just trying to find out if this is additional powers that you're giving the department, or it's something that you currently already have.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this only deals with the power for us to make a referral to another agency. It doesn't give us any particular powers beyond that to share information to the appropriate agency to investigate a situation. Generally, if the guardian is acting in the best interest, and we don't have concerns about the guardian, then we follow the guardian direction.
I'm going to try one more. So if you don't feel it does, not necessarily that you have proof that they're not, but you just feel that they're not, then that's what gives, this bill gives you the authority then to investigate more yourself, just based on how you feel about it, or give it to the fraud unit or wherever you think it may need to go.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, maybe if I explain by a situation. So we had an individual who had a power of attorney. He was a gentleman who had significant dementia. He was not able to fully explain his concerns, but we would go to visit him, and he would say, my money, help me, my money." So we visited many times, and he always brought up that same issue. We talked with his power of attorney. We asked her to assist us in finding a way to help him understand how his money's been spent. For example, we asked for his bank records so we could show him, and she was not able to did not provide that upon repeated requests. And then at one point he assaulted her when they were out on an outing. He ended up in API. We went to visit him there, and at that point, he again, after 6 weeks, was still talking about his money. We made a referral to the Office of Elder Fraud, who did an investigation and found out that the daughter was indeed spending $3,000 of his dollars every month for herself. I don't know if that clarifies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? Seeing no further questions, I guess the next order of business here would be the fiscal notes. Representative Guerra, if you could read those into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 83 has two fiscal notes, OMB Component 2749 for the Department of Revenue, Mental Health Trust Authority, Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office. That is a zero fiscal note. And OMB Component 2663. Also a zero fiscal note for the Department of Health and Social Services.
Okay, do we have any questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing no questions, I'd like to entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I move CS for SB 83S version 30GS1815/D from Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Do we have any objections? Okay, seeing no objections, CS for SB 83 version D is reported from the House Finance Committee, and if we could have folks sign the report. Thank you. So with that, we will now move over to SB 78, which is the Permanent Fund Dividend Contributions and Lottery Bill by Senator Bishop. We have also a CS for the committee, but if Senator Bishop and his aide, thank you. If you could both put yourselves on the record. First of all, let's go ahead and put the CS before the committee. Let's adopt that. So if I could have a motion to bring the CS for CS for SB 78 for us.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 78 version 30LS0534-L before the committee as a working draft.
And we have an objection. Representative Wilson. Okay. At this time, I'd like to have Senator Bishop and his aide, Pete Feldman, if they could please put yourselves on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Chair Foster, members of the Finance Committee, good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to present SB 78 today. Just a brief opening. It's been 6 years before I sat at this table, and it hasn't changed. I have to sit on the end so I can get under it. with that being said, in the lateness of the hour, and I am in another committee with another bill, I'll roll through my opening statement, and if you have any questions, I'll entertain those, and if I can't, as Chief of Staff Pete Feldman will take it from there. So, again, thank you. 78, it is I think a creative way to fund education for now and into the future. And I always come out with these statements, and I look at them, and I just turn it over and go, because I never stick to the script. We all value education, everybody sitting here in this room and everybody sitting in this building. And as our, you know, we're not having 2 million barrels a day of throughput through Trans-Alaska Pipeline. We need to diversify our economy. This is a way to diversify our economy from now and into the future. Will it completely close the gap on education funding with UGF funds? No. But it's going to set up, if passed, an endowment model, not unlike what mental health budget does. I know when I sat on the other committee in finance, when mental health trust comes to the committee, it's like a love in. Everybody wants to see mental health trust because they're funded with a POMV endowment model and helps fund their budget. It works. And this bill will go a long way towards helping fund education in a new way. And Chief of Staff will get into the mechanics of the bill. But I think it's high time we look outside the box, bring an alternative funding stream into education funding. I think this is a vehicle that gets us there. It's totally voluntary. It's not a mandate on anybody. And I think it's important. You know, I've tried, I've had several opportunities to fund education with another bill. I looked at bringing another vehicle, bringing our education head techs back, and it wasn't, the time wasn't ready a couple years ago for that. This is another way. Right now it's a revenue bill to help get revenue into education, and I know if your emails are like my emails, I have a lot of people saying, please use part of my earnings to run government. Please fund education. So here is a voluntary way to step up to the plate and fund education. And so if it does see the light of day and it does pass, we're gonna see how much people are committed to education, and I think they are. But bigger than that, when the endowment does hit to its cap, and Pete will get into that, it will be self-perpetuating. So with that, I will just step back and let you have any questions for me. And if not, I'll let Chief of Staff take over.
Very good. Does the committee have any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I just received a thank you for being here. And I just received a communication from folks in Homer, and there was a question on the raffle, and would that form of legalizing gambling at all give any impetus to tribal governments to, or an opening there so that would be applied?
I'll defer to Mr. Feldman.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, my name is Pete Feldman, staff with Senator Bishop. Excuse me. I've been struggling with the Juno crud. This is just all we're doing here is we're amending the current gambling laws to allow for another raffle. There's 16 raffles or classics or bull moose derbies, however you want to name them. There's 16 variations that are already allowed for in the state of Alaska. We're just allowing for another bucket raffle to be exempt from the gambling law that currently exists. This is not changing the gambling laws. We're just existing this raffle just like the other 16 raffles that have been already exempted in current law.
A question from Representative Guerra and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate both of you came to my office to try and explain the bill. I've got questions, but I do appreciate you trying to think outside the box to try and figure out how to move ahead on education. Here's my main question. Right now, from the other body, we got an education budget that cut something like $65 million out of public education. To my community and around the state, I find that devastating. And with the $1,000 dividend plan, we're told, I guess with that plan, that's the education budget the other body feels good about. I can't tell from this bill how much of that $69 million of cut education funds we could feel confident we would get back from this bill. It seems $5 million the first year. Is that it's a guess? Is that fair?
Representative Garrett through the chair. So all we have is a spreadsheet that runs all the possibilities. And so if a minimum number of people, say 20,000 people or 50,000 people, gave X number of dollars, we would have a, 50% of whatever was donated would go directly in to the public education fund. So we don't know what's going to be donated. We have lots of projections. They're fun to look at, but it'd be really hard to know for sure what will actually go directly into the education fund.
Okay, through the chair.
Representative Bureau.
And I'm one who thinks that like all good ideas should move forward, so I do want to take a look at this and see whether it should be part of an end of session package maybe. But the other concern, which I think we discussed this morning, is if people are donating part of their permanent fund dividend under this bill to education, they might think that education funding will go up if they donate it. But it may be they donate their check, and as we see in the Senate proposal, education funding actually goes down. There's nothing in here that says if you donate your money that funding will go up, and there's nothing that tells somebody who donates their permanent fund dividend, this may result still in a lower education budget than last year. So are you open to try and figure out how to address that? Maybe a warning to somebody that education funding may still go down if they donate their dividend, or make a donation, spending of the donation contingent on education funding going up?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, if I could just, could I step back to the other body just for a little bit, and I apologize, I'm not 100% on my A game because I'm trying to unwind oil taxes out of my head on 111 over there and then come jump right into this. But on that point,
on your point, that
on, and that's what I like about this room. If I could digress for a minute, there's a lot of good memories here. But I had another senator in the other body that didn't like this bill at all, and I asked him to respectfully read the bill and don't judge the book by its cover, and consequently that happened, and he said, I like the book, and can you, but I don't like the word lottery, and so I've put, now we call it a raffle at his suggestion, and So to answer your question, I can't give you a hard yes or no at this point. I'd have to go back and think about that and process that. But I will say, some of you are sitting here, have been here longer. You know, I've been to Juneau now 12 years and presenting in front of this body six of those years. We still have the power to appropriate as the legislature. So I would like to come back to and give the vice chair an answer to that at a later date. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks.
We've got next up Representative Guttenberg and then Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a similar concern that I expressed with the senator that Representative Seaton talked about, and I know we're exempting this from under gaming, but I don't see the opinion that I thought was asked for the department from legal services. I could probably not back yet, but even though we exempt the state from this from gaming, the federal laws and regulations that govern some of the tribal gaming issues might be on the table, and I would certainly like to see that opinion one way or the other. I mean, it would help clarify it. I don't know if we have obviously haven't gotten that back. We haven't gotten that. I see the indication we haven't gotten that back. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Feldman?
Mr. Chairman, if you would like, I could go and explain the changes in the CS. I didn't understand if that was a question from Representative Guttenberg or not, Mr. Chairman, or is it just a statement?
Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. It was a request to get a nod from your staff over there, Mr. Chairman, and I got it.
Okay.
Or a nod or a shake.
We do have a question from Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. Thank you. And thanks for coming to my office so I could learn a little bit more about this in advance. Just a couple questions just to lay on the table. Currently under the PFD, we have two options for donating. One is for the college tuition. The other one's for Pick, Click, Give. And then there's that whole group of Pick, Click, Give participants. So would this essentially just be a third checkbox?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, that's correct.
And then through the chair.
Representative Kawasaki.
And then, so we just got a letter, I can't remember, maybe just a day or two ago, that from the Pick, Click, Give administrator folks that say that if you do this, it might have an unintended consequence of less money going out to those particular charities. Do you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, our feeling is, and lots of the research shows, that people donate to charities for really just a couple of reasons. One is that they are very committed and believe highly in the charity work and the charities that the things that they're doing. And the other reason is that they donate as a tax break. So our belief is that people who really are committed to these charitable donations will continue to donate. Will we affect how much money goes to those? That's yet to be seen. But I think the people who donate to charities donate, and they have a sincere belief in those charities, and they seek to support those.
Okay. And then just one more.
Representative Kawasaki.
So the issue of gambling keeps coming up. Just me personally, we did have a chance to talk about this, as gambling is sort of a tax on poor people and people who are really bad at statistics. And that's really the underlying trouble that I have when it comes to gambling in general. And I just wanted to hear from your standpoint. You know, there's a lot of folks that do sport education, I get that, and there's a lot of folks that do want to win a lottery because they know that there's potential upside for them. And I just wanted to hear your comments about that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, we try to get down to the question again. I'm sorry, I lost it.
Just that, you know, there's a lot of folks that'll see this potentially as, you know, this is the person that's pull tabs. They get their paycheck. They think they're going to win something big. They spend all their week's salary on pull tabs instead of taking care of diapers and other things that should be a higher priority. And I, you know, you see that in a lot of places that have gambling, and I just wanted to hear a comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Kawasaki. The thing about this raffle is it's a limited raffle. You can only play from your permanent fund. You can only play once a year. You can't take money from any other source and play. This is a strictly limited raffle. You can only play from your permanent fund dividend check, and you can donate as much of that check as you like, but you can only donate up to the top of whatever your permanent fund check is. Another note, everybody is after your permanent fund. You have to consider the fact that Alaska Airlines is after your permanent fund. People fly out of here and go to Las Vegas and they gamble. Walmart is after your permanent fund. People buy new TVs and toys and so on. All we're trying to do is tap in a little bit and give people an opportunity to donate to education and maybe have a little fun while they do it. So in the state of Alaska, everybody knows when it's PFD time. And, but this is limited. You can't sit down and spend your whole paycheck doing rippies. Now, we know that last year, $388 million was spent on charitable gaming. Out of that $388 million was spent, only $30 million of that actually went to charitable organizations. The rest of that money was spent on winners, on administration, and so on and so on. And so this is a limited opportunity to donate part of your permanent fund, support your children, and maybe have a little bit of fun. And I might point out that with this raffle, 95% of the money that's donated is either held for education or goes directly into education. There's not another raffle, another charitable donation in the state that can say that. And I'll just give you one example off the top of my head. We all love the Ice Classic. $700,000 was taken in for Ice Classic tickets this year. Of that $700,000, $300,000 will be paid out in prizes. $300,000, give or take a few, will be held for administration fees, cost to run the program, and so on. Only $50,000 of this for charitable donations will actually go to charitable donations. The difference with this piece of legislation is 95% of this money is either held for education or goes directly into the education budget.
And just one final, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And just to clarify, I can't find it in the bill. I just ran through it really quick. But this would preclude a parent from using a kid's PFD for the lottery. Is that correct? It's somewhere in the bill. I just can't
remember. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, that is correct. You have to be 18 years of age or older to donate to this fund. Now, in some other instances in the state of Alaska, and just I'll say pick, click, give, a parent can donate a child's permanent fund to pick, click, give. We don't allow that. You have to be an adult in order to play this lottery. This raffle. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
And I know Representative Wilson has a question here. I just want to also remind folks we've got the motion to adopt the House CS for committee substitute for Senate Bill 78 before us. And so I know that Representative Wilson, you've got a question here. And maybe after that, if folks have any questions on the changes to the CS, we can address that. And then we'll go to the motion. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And maybe they could go over the changes versus questions on it. I just have one quick one, though. So, Pick, Click, and Give right now has a sweepstakes if you donate money currently, correct?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Wilson.
So, follow-up?
Follow-up.
So, you're basically doing the same thing. You're just making it, though, that it's donated to this one education fund, and you're going to give them something winning money, I'm sorry, I don't know what the sweepstakes, and when we get somebody from Pick, Click, and Give, we can ask them what somebody wins, because I don't know what it is, but technically you're doing exactly the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did we, maybe Mr. Feldman, if you could walk through the changes, and then we'll adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I'd love to do so. So it's really pretty basic, and I'll just go right down the line and explain the changes, and then if I might, I could explain afterwards why these changes are coming into play. And so the first change, actually, there's two places on page 5, line 17 and line 18, where we're deleting $500 million, and we're putting in $300 million.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I just want to be, we are on version L, the work draft.
Right, version
okay,
L.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Which page again?
This would be page 5.
Mr. Feldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next change occurs on page 6, line 5, and we're deleting 10% and inserting 8%. The next change again is on page 6, line 7. We're deleting 5% and we're inserting 4%. And then the next page, again on page 6, line 9, we're going to delete 3% and insert 2. And on page 6 again, line 11, we're going to delete 2 and insert 1%.
Does the committee have any questions on the changes before we adopt the CS? Seeing no questions, is the objection maintained?
No, I remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any further objections on the motion to adopt the CS as our working draft? Seeing none, the CS for committee substitute for Senate Bill 78. Version L is before the committee. Are there any further questions on the bill? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you're going to explain, you didn't get an opportunity to explain the reasons for those changes that you made, those changes to the bill. You want to do that now for me, please?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, yes. Thank you. So as we, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, thank you. As we ran the spreadsheets and we went through the process on the Senate side, we discovered that as in certain areas, as the donation numbers got to the max, so let's say 400,000 people gave their maximum permanent fund, there were certain areas 20 years out where the amount of money that we could pay out would be not equal to, but getting close to, the amount of money that we took in. So we were concerned because even though we're investing this money and we're gaining money, we were concerned that we need to make sure we were always putting money into the RAPL and it was secure. So we reduced the amount, the cap of the RAPL fund so that it would spend money up into the Education Endowment Fund sooner. So instead of capping it at $500 million, we capped it at $300 million. So everything above that now will jump right up into the Education Endowment Fund. And the other thing we did is we reduced the payouts by just a few percentages so that we're not handing out, you know, and we'd really be happy if we could cap this and hand out a $50 million prize, but that'll take a long time for that happens. But we did reduce the payout amounts by enough percentages that now if we get into a situation 10 or 20 or 15 years from now, or whatever the case may be, that we're still putting, you know, an excess amount of money into the lottery fund, then we can spin it up into the endowment fund. So it was a measure to make this so it has more longevity, easier to manage, and more security.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I said something before, but I might as well ask you, Mr. Feldman. I mean, we get a budget from the other body at cuts $65 million from education, and then we adopt this bill, and somebody, I think, donates $1,000 thinking they're going to increase education funding. But then if they donated $1,000 and education funding went down by another $65 million, I think they would feel like they were misled. And so the fix, I think, would be, I mean, A, so, I mean, is do you think I'm wrong about that? So, yeah, do you think I'm wrong about that? Do you think somebody's expectation would be that education funding would go up, and if they saw education funding go down, again, they'd feel like they were misled?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think that people already see education funding going down. I think as long as we're in a bad market with oil, we're going to expect, and they're going to expect to see more cuts. We're hopeful, like everybody in the state of Alaska, that we're not going to stay in a situation where we're in these negative numbers for oil, and that the price of oil will come up and our budget will be secure again. There's other measures out there that we've talked about. You and I talked about today that, you know, we have tax bills out there that are education tax. They're labeled education tax bills. Can we guarantee that money will be paid to education? No, we can't. And so our position is that hopefully our economy will rebound and that this will be a positive thing. We can't ever guarantee the public anything when it comes to appropriating money. You're right. All of the numbers that you see with lotteries, there's 15 states that use education, I mean, that have lottery money that they pay to education. And yes, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes the overall budget for the state drops, I mean, the budget for education from the state goes down, and they fill the money back in from the lottery money. And oftentimes that happens, but yet it's still money that's going to education. If the legislature feels like there's still need to reduce the education budget, that's the legislature's call, that at least this money is something that we could count on to come in and help prop up education.
I'm not ruling out that this shouldn't be part of a plan. It raises some money, right? So, and that's the positive part of it, and it's done voluntarily. That's the other positive part of it. But the more I think about it, I think there should be a disclaimer if somebody donates part of their permanent fund, they know that under this bill, education funding might go down even if they donated some of their permanent fund. I just think their expectation would be that if they donated $1,000, that would go towards an increase in education funding. And if that's not going to be the case, I think we have to have a disclaimer of some sort.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guerra, Senator Bishop has always open to working and trying to improve bills. We've changed this bill a lot in all the committee hearings we've had. If we can work with you and try to discuss this, we're not opposed to trying to maybe figure out a way, maybe a button on the application or something that tells people this money is intended for, but it will not necessarily increase education funding. Something. I'm not opposed to speaking with Senator Bishop about the possibilities.
And I'm not opposed to changing my mind. I could be wrong.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up from Representative Guerra, since you can only do this once, which means that we can only do it if it passes between January 1st and March 30th, which would be before a budget came out, I don't know how a disclaimer would work, because that's when we can donate to. If this were to pass, we would only be between that time period.
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, so our vision is that the very year that you make your donations, we're also going to have the drawing. And that very year, the money that goes directly to the education fund should come out and go directly in the education fund that very year. So the timing, like you're saying, okay, are we going to be done with our budget already? I think we will. And so it will be added to whatever the previous year funding was, is the way we hope this is going to work, and unless we make changes in the committee.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So I kind of understand where Representative Garrett is trying to go. The same issue I have calling an income tax an education tax. Again, you know, we can call things the way we want, but on this particular one, we're having such a closed area as far as when you can donate, and if it's going to go into the same year, I think it would be hard to make that distinction. But perhaps, you know, maybe during the commercials or those parts of it, But I think, again, because what you said before, most lotteries, and I know this is not a lottery, it goes to replace most general fund dollars. But I think at this point, the more things that we can come up with that are directed, you know, towards something everybody feels that is important, is at least giving that right concept to go with it. And what was the first year? What did you think the first year, as far as how much would go into the into education on your numbers?
And through the chair, Representative Wilson. So we can just talk in general numbers. And I do, there is a spreadsheet that would show in your packet. So we're going to be looking at a couple things. The one that I have in front of me, if I could direct you to that spreadsheet, there's one spreadsheet that reflects the change in the percentages we pay out. So it, down in the bottom in the yellow, it would be 8%, 4%, 2%, and 1%. There's the other one represents the bill as it came to committee, which would be 10%, 5%, 3%, 2%. So those are the bottom numbers. So what the one I'm looking at is going to be the one that has the 8% for the first prize payout down at the very bottom in yellow. So let's just say at the top you have year 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And what we did is we put 50,000 people in that could donate $200. In that situation, right below that you see the Public Education Fund, $5 million that year would go directly into education, right off the top. That year it's done, it's in the education fund, and it's helping fund education. Then you have the education endowment gets the 2.5, and then you have the lottery fund gets the 2.5. And so below that, then, you'll see the bars that show, of course, first prize. It's all the way over to the left. First prize, second prize, third prize, fourth prize. Those are the prize payouts, which are fairly good odds and fairly good payouts for people to donate their part of their permanent fund. And so that, if you go across the top now, so your question about public education, you can see that if we go all the way to the end of year 10, and beyond that, you have the 10-year total. All the way across, the 10-year total, straight money, no money invested, just money coming off of this scenario, is $240 million paid directly into education, no bars. And then the other two are the monies, that, of course, that go into the education endowment and the other for the lottery fund.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
And what do you see the education endowment, what are you going to utilize, or do you see it being utilized by the education endowment portion?
So the and this might be a good point through the chair, Representative Wilson, to maybe talk about just our little chart. If I could hold it up, we have a little John Manley special before he left us, and it may make it easier to discuss how it really works. We can go to the mechanics. So as we've been talking about, you can see we have the three pots of money. The Public Education Fund is the top pot, and that's the one that gets 50% of all the donations straight off the top. The Education Endowment Fund is 25% of the total donated, and then you have the Dividend Raffle Fund. So the Education Endowment Fund doesn't get touched until it reaches $1 billion. You can see, oh, this one doesn't have the cap. Anyway, so it's capped in the statute. It's capped at $1 billion. Then it will be managed. It will be managed the whole time, like a POMB, so they're gonna have to manage it so it's at 4% or more and do some good management on it. Once it hits the $1 billion mark, then they look back 4 years. It's a POMB payment, and it goes directly into the public education fund. So that education endowment doesn't get touched until such a time that it reaches its cap, and then it starts to feed the public education fund. And so then the last 25%, of course, that's the lottery fund. And the lottery fund works in a similar way, except for what you have to do now is you got to kind of forget about those two top pots and just think about the lottery fund. So we have 25% of the donations in that lottery fund. Of that 25%, 20% of that will be used under, not the CS, excuse me, but I'm going to say 20%, will be used to pay out in prizes. That leaves 80% of those donations stay in the raffle bucket. The next year's donations go on top of that 80%, and they're added together. And so the next year's payout, you pay out of whatever that balance was, the next year's donations go on top of it. Once we cap that at now $300 million, everything above that $300 million goes directly into the public education endowment. So now we're feeding the endowment from donations, and we're feeding the endowment from whatever's left from the lottery fund. So we're actually accelerating. We're gaining steam as we go, because the higher the donations go, the faster the money rolls into the endowment, the faster the money rolls into the raffle, which hits its cap, triggers the money to go into that endowment. Once the endowment is topped off, everything that we make from these donations, because you got to remember, there's always going to be 25% feeding the endowment. There's always going to be the money left from the raffle fund. Plus, we're going to be investing that money in the endowment. So once it hits its cap, now it's going to start feeding the public education fund, you know, from the cap of the endowment. So we're feeding this thing from lots of different ways and allowing this money to grow, and it's all voluntary. And the point is, of all this money, 95% is either held for education or is paid directly into the public education fund. There's not another charitable donation in the state that can say that.
And one last question.
Reverend Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So basically what you're saying, we're starting out at 50% in the public education, but that 50%, once those other targets are met, will grow to 55, 60, 65% as people keep donating, because those other two buckets will top out and everything will then have to be into the public education fund.
If I understand you through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. It gets fed in a bunch of different ways once it really starts moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I guess I had a question, and that was, this is starting out year one at $10 million total anticipated donations. What does PICLIC give, receive annually?
Mr. Chairman, this year, and I don't have the exact number, but I know that it was $2.5 million to $3 million was what PICLIC give had this year. I think it was closer to $3 million this year. $2.5 million, I think, last year, someplace in between those two numbers. The interesting thing, of course, about Pick, Click, Give is they distribute that money to over 600 different organizations, and so it gets spread pretty thin, you know, for the $2.5 to $3 million that they do. And that doesn't count. I don't know, have any idea what their administration costs are. I don't know whether those costs come out of the donations. I really don't know any more than that.
I'm just trying to figure out if we're saying we have 600 individual charities that people are very connected to within their local communities as well as statewide, and we're getting $2 to $3 million into that, and here is a state program that would be giving back to probably displacing state general fund money.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to figure out, do you have some study or some analysis that actually says that you anticipate that there would be three times as much donations to this state as to all of the charities that Pick, Click, Give and all of the work that they've done generating, you know, advertisements and all those things to try to encourage donations? And now we're saying that, gee, in the first year, if we put this forward out there, I mean, is it the raffle portion of this that is going to make it three times larger than Pick, Click, Give in the first year, or am I just, I haven't seen the study, and so I wondered if, do you have any kind of outside analysis or study that says it'll do that?
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Revenue, we had a discussion and talked about the numbers across top. That's why we were very conservative, we think, in the first year and second year and so on. I have no idea. I know that if you take $2.5 million, you know, this donated a pick, click, give, and you distribute amongst 600 or 700 entities, it's getting spread fairly thin. People are committed to that. It's a great program. I have no idea what the administration costs are. It's a fairly complicated program. If you think about it, for computer programming, you've got to be able to track all these different donations. You got to track where they go and who's paying what and how to. So it's fairly complicated. This program is a standalone program. It's not connected to Click, Pick, Give. This program has three buckets to put the money in and four winners. We have very few moving parts in this program. And so our administration costs, of course, can be quite low compared to what, and for Pick, Click, Give, you would think managing it has to have a fair amount of cost based on the fact that it's expensive computer programming, it takes time to do, you have to track all these donations, so on. I don't know the details about Pick, Click, Give. I'm sure that somebody is here who would like to talk about that. But our view is that because this is an inducement, when in the state of Alaska there's $388 million spent on basically at poll tabs. You know, people in Alaska like to participate in games of chance. We buy our bucket raffle tickets when we go to the Chamber of Commerce meeting. These are all the same. This falls within the same type of donation process, is just a bigger one. $388 million donated is good. But the fact is that only $30 million of that went directly to charitable organizations. And that's not Pick, Click, Give, but that's just charitable gaming in the state. And so we feel like the inducement to have a chance to win a little something always plays with people. People like to play games of chance. We have 16 games of chance in the state of Alaska, and people play them. And so we think this is an inducement that it will, in fact, get a lot of participation.
And the question was, is there any study that shows what impact or pull away from the current program you anticipate with this inducement to pull $10 million out of the...
Mr. Chairman, we've just introduced this bill 40 days ago, and to do a study like that would be very costly, I'm sure. You know, we've built in 2% into this program, so we actually fund ourselves for administration, all except for the first year. The revenue says they can help us out with some creative advertising and so on, but we've built in our own administration costs and so on. We just have not had and don't really know where we would find the money as Senator Bishop to do a study.
We have Representative Ortiz and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's while you can't do a study, would you agree that it's pretty, if we were to implement this, it would have a significant impact on the Pick, Click, and Give program? Or is it the thought that the kind of people who might be interested in gaming aren't the same kind of people who would be interested in donating?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ortiz, I would think, excuse me, that when the permanent fund check was reduced this year, that had a bigger impact on Pick, Click, Give than anything we'll do. And yes, I think this is a different market. I think the people that are interested in playing this are interested in gambling. They're the folks who think that we probably are going to get their Alaska Airlines special during PFD time and head to Las Vegas and play. I've had lots of phone calls from people who say, I send money down to my relatives in Washington State so they can play the Powerball for me. You know, this is a group of people who are interested in games of chance. People who donate to their charitable organizations have sincere convictions about those charitable organizations, and I don't think we change their sincere convictions. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, in perhaps getting back to Representative Guerra's concern. Do you see this as a way to augment our current obligations that we make in the legislature to education, or to supplement? Or is there a difference between those two? I think there's a difference between those two words.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ortiz, I wish I could speak for future legislatures, and the situation that we are in today is obviously very grieving and difficult. We're going to create another pot of money that we can help the children with. We hope that the legislature will future legislators will be wise and understand that this is a bonus. We hope that. But really, we have no way of guaranteeing that.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with you, Mr. Feldman. I think this is a completely different group of people than Pick, Click, Live. I think this is a group of people that are just interested in gambling, and certainly that is very different from people that are punching the button for Pick, Click, Live. But I want to ask you about some of the assumptions in your spreadsheet. You know, in the in number of participants, first year you go 50,000, second year 150,000. You jump up to 300,000. That's if you just keep the static number of adults getting the permanent fund. I guess it's this one is from Division of Revenue, I assume. You're talking about more than half of every Alaskan putting in $200 a year. Where is that assumption from?
Mr. Chairman, we think, based on the performance of other state lotteries, and when you see the trend where the lottery or the Powerball is starting to rise, they've also seen a trend in the number of people who play. So the bigger the prize gets, the more people want to play. And it's trendy. It's throughout. There's a bunch of studies on that. That we have access to, and I could bring to your office. And so when you look, when you start to see that by the time, if you look at even year two, at 150,000 people giving $200, that's a $700,000 payout. The next year is $1.4 million if we get 200,000 people at $200. Imagine this. The governor goes and announces the amount of the PFD check, and at the same time hands out three checks for nearly $1 million. People will get excited about that. The odds are better at this payout than anything else you'll ever see. Four winners, you have 300,000 people donating, and only the people who donate can play. So your odds are very good that somebody you know is going to have an opportunity to win this, and it will be exciting to people, and we think people will choose to play.
My name, Mr. Chairman.
Representative,
yeah, thank you. Well, you know, I love your enthusiasm, and that's great. The only raffle tickets I buy are ones I buy because over the years I've sold them. So I figure if I'm selling them, I got to buy something, right? But you know, and I just put it in a drawer and forget about it because I'm not buying it to win. But you're talking about taking hundreds of millions of dollars out of the economy, out of people's pockets, and putting it into the fund and giving it to winners. I mean, this is, at the end of the day, that enthusiasm is something I'm concerned about. The history of gambling and the cost, the social cost to people, and even though you're just rolling this around in the economy, because that's all you're doing, basically you're paying teachers and fuel for schools. I'm just wondering if I see your enthusiasm, and that's great, but I just don't know how realistic the assumptions are and the number of participants. And you know, one of the concerns I have is at the end of the day, it doesn't create the numbers that your assumptions are built upon. It just becomes a lottery, which is really isn't funding anything except the lottery and winners.
Before we get into really committee discussion, okay, I want to make sure we get questions. And also I wanted everybody to know that we also have Sarah Race with the director of the Permanent Fund Division, and Scott Jones, a state comptroller at the Department of Revenue, online if people have questions there as well. So
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Representative Guttenberg, 95% of this money that is donated goes to education. That we know. 5% is going to spin around in the economy. You know, anything we do as a legislative body is going to affect the money in the economy. If we tax people, it's going to affect the money in the economy. If we change the way we pay out the permanent fund, it's going to affect the money in the economy. This is not a good situation to be in. All we're doing is offering a way for people to donate. It's a free and willing donation, and some people will benefit, but 95% of that money goes to education, and it benefits our children.
Thanks. And what we would like to do is we have some people that have flown in to testify.
Yeah.
And so if we can, since you'll be around, Mr. Feldman, we can bring you back.
But here for 20 years, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
So we have Deborah Bitney here to testify. Deborah Bitney, are you online? Are you here? What's that?
Yes. Oh, shall I leave the table? Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's see. Do we have Nina? Let's see. These are in Anchorage. We have folks here in the room that were invited testimony. Okay, let's go to Alaska Community Foundation, Pick, Click, Give. Nina Kemple, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Great. Would you go ahead and put yourself on the record and go ahead with your testimony?
I certainly can. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Finance Committee. Thank you for taking my testimony today and allowing me to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 78. For the record, my name is Nina Kemple. I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation, which is a statewide public foundation created by the people of Alaska to support charitable giving across the state. We work with donors, nonprofit organizations, community members, our 9 affiliate community foundations across the state to grow philanthropy. And we administer approximately $3 to $4 million of grants and scholarships each year in Alaska and manage statewide projects such as Pick, Click, Give program. So I'm happy to address any questions, but before I do, I would like to make a simple statement. The Pick, Click, Give program is managed by the Alaska Community Foundation, but it's also part of a much larger partnership with other organizations, including the Forefront Group, who I believe you'll hear from shortly, Rasmussen Foundation, United Way, and obviously everyone at the Department of Revenue with the state of Alaska. It is a natural partnership that we all work together to support this very important and critical program for our nonprofits across the state. The Alaska Community Foundation supports the sort of day-to-day operations of the Pick, Click, Give program, including the website, the interface with the 688 nonprofits that participate in the program, as well as some of the outreach campaigns that we conduct to support the overall program. I'd like to be clear that the Alaska Community Foundation and myself are not here in opposition to Senate Bill 78, but rather to encourage this group to consider the potentially unintended consequences of the addition of this bill to what the implications might have on Pick, Click, Give program itself. And what we're asking for is that we actually have further consideration in some of the questions that were already asked today, and that this bill be further researched and given additional thought and questions into the implications that it might have on the nonprofit sector across the state of Alaska. And we're here because we feel like we, the Alaska Community Foundation, has an obligation to the nonprofits who we serve by Pick, Click, Give, and to express their concerns. That we study this this introduction of this bill with the full ability to look into some of the very difficult questions that I think have been already addressed today. I would say that the committee at the Alaska Legislature recommended as early as 3 years ago the importance of this program being self-sustaining. So when we addressed the question of what the overhead cost is to run Pick, Click, Give, I can actually tell you that the overhead cost in total is 15% to run the Pickwick Give program. 7% of that comes out of the charitable giving, and we have all the participants in the nonprofits that participate voluntarily opt in as an organization who's willing to contribute 7% to the overhead costs that support things like advertisers and collective marketing. The other portion of the overhead cost comes from our private donors and people who believe very much in the Pickwick Give program and how it promotes philanthropy across the state and helps multi-generational philanthropy in ways that we feel is fundamentally important to our state. I think the Rose Metallica group is going to talk about the process in which we went through around Pickwick Give and the 3 years that it took us to study the introduction of that program and the importance of actually studying it to get it right. And I think what we're asking today is that we actually invest the same amount of due diligence into the implication of having educational funding being supported by a raffle and the impact it may have on the nonprofit sector and on Pickwick Give. But I would just like to be, again, very clear that we are in no way asking for increased funding at the Rescue Family Foundation, or we're not opposing Senate Bill 78 or arguing against the importance of educational funding. In fact, we believe strongly in all of those. Rather, here is an obligation to the nonprofit sector, to the state, and the donors that give to the nonprofit organizations through Pickwick Give, and we just want to ask for the consideration that this bill actually be further studied and looked into with the implications that it may have on Pickwick Give and the charitable giving program that we have in place that is doing wonderful things for our state. So with that, I thank you for consideration of my testimony.
Thank you. And if you have that as written testimony, if you'd send it in, that would be helpful. We have a couple of questions here. Representative Guerra and then Wilson and Pruitt.
You know, this is Representative Lescara. Really, this probably applies to all the folks online, but I just wanted to thank you for all the work you do in the community.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guerra, I appreciate that very much. It is a wonderful honor to represent a program such as Pickwick Give that I think fundamentally makes our state a better place.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So could you tell me, do you know how much was actually donated to your charity and then how much the charity actually received?
So, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think the question is, so we run this program for 688 nonprofit organizations, all of which get some form of donations. Those vary in amount from, you know, $25 single donation up to $115,000 in each given year, depending on the organization and depending on the engagement of the organization within the program. But of that, the organization receives 93% of that directly back to them. And, you know, we work with each organization individually to try to help them maximize their fundraising potential during the Pickwick season, and that 7% is dedicated to doing just that, to having the ability to do public marketing campaigns that you probably all heard on the radio over the last couple of the last 7 months, but to also support them with the tools that they need to promote it with their own donors on the individual level.
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm a little confused. So you said that 93% go to the organizations, but while ago you said there was 15% administrative fees.
That is correct. So 7% of the administrative fees comes from the voluntary participation of organizations participating. So that's the 7%. The remaining 8%, the total of 15%, comes from our private partnership with organizations across the state that and donors who believe in the Pickwick Give program, such as the Atkinson Foundation, and United Way, and Poker Group, and the Community Foundation to support the rest of the remaining 8%. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that.
So let me see if I can clarify, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So although it's 15% administrative fees, you're getting some private donations to cover that 8%. And so if I were to give $100 to an organization, $7 of that $100 is going to be utilized for the administrative fee, and then the other $93 would go to the organization.
That is correct.
But we're still trying to, Mr. Chairman, we're still covering 15%. So although you're giving 93%, if you lose any of that other private donation, it would then have to be taken out of the charitable portion, correct?
That is correct. I mean, the thinking here is that over time, the 7% actually will be sustainable to support the program as the intent and goal. In the process of us growing the program, there is private funding that's helping to support it. The state actually pays absolutely no portion of this funding. So it is actually, if you gave $100, $93 would go back to the charity at choice, and there is some portion that would be covered by the Alaska Community Foundation. And ultimately, our concern here is that if the impact of this Senate Bill 78 has on FICLIT Give goes makes actually FICLIT Give go down in nature, it actually makes it more challenging for us to be sustainable and actually requires us to find additional funding outside the bill to support the program.
Thank you. And I just wanted members to know we also have Elizabeth Riffley, who's the board chair of the 4-Acre Group, online to testify, and we have Deborah Bitney, who's vice president, chief administrative officer, Rasmussen, as online as well. So we have other testifiers too. Let's see, Representative Pruitt, and then Guttenberg and Ortiz. And if you want to spread those questions out to someone else, that's fine.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair, because it's really a continuation of the discussion on the administration, trying to understand how it's administered and how this would potentially be impacted with that. And so I'll ask Ms. Kimple, and if someone else feels they can better answer it, that's fine. In continuing the conversation just a little bit, earlier we heard Mr. Feldman wasn't completely sure in terms of speaking to how PICA GLIV is administered, and I figure you might be able to help. If you're not, please point me to someone else. Right now, is the money just if a person goes in and says I'm going to donate $100, and of course collectively everyone does that to the different organizations, does the state participate in helping to administer that through some sort of software program, et cetera, or is it just you are given the total amount that has been that has been earmarked for the various programs, and then you take it from there? What is the administrative cost to the state under the current Pick, Click, Give system? Is there anything that we have to deal with that whether it's a permanent fund dividend organization that pays for it?
So, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think I would direct this question to Sarah Page, who I believe is also on the line, who may be able to answer that. But from our perspective, I would say we work in partnership with the Department of Revenue on this program, and we feel very strongly that's an effective partnership for the way we go about addressing the process in which the funding actually flows through the system and the website and the technology platform in which we use and share together. So I would actually defer the question to the state.
Okay, no problem. And I will do that, Mr. Chair.
We have them online.
Perfect. And one more follow-up. I actually think Sarah's here. We can either have her come up now or later. That's up to you, Mr. Chair.
I think we'll do it later. But
yeah. One other just quick follow-up, and that is related to the 15% the administration. Does that include – I know there's incentives out there for organizations to encourage people to donate through Pick a Give to their organization. And in turn, they may benefit by getting some sort of a
some sort of cash program. Like I just saw recently, I think it was a sponsored ad from Pick, Click, Give, with $5,000 going to Planned Parenthood of Alaska and Hawaii. Is that through that 15% that money comes from? And is that from the 7% that is out of the individuals that have donated, or does that come from the private money that's through? And subsequently, if this were to impact the amount of money that comes to you, following up on the continuation from what Representative Wilson.
Can you ask the question?
Yeah, no, I'm I appreciate it, but no, I'm trying to figure out where would that come? Would they continue to do that, and would it come from that private? I'm trying to figure out.
At some point here, we have a bill before us that is doing a raffle, and we're getting too far into the weeds on the administrative details of a different program, and all we were doing here is asking, will this program and the bill that we have before us impact another program that we have on the table? So I don't want to get into trying to take a whole, we can have another hearing on Pick, Click, Give if people want to, but today we're looking at a bill that we have before us, and we're looking at to see if there's an impact between the two programs. So,
yes, Mr. Chair. I recognize that, and that's kind of why I was asking, because if she has indicated that this is going to impact them, I'm trying to understand the long term. Will we be continuing to facilitate some of these programs, or will it be pulling away from those? And then what is the fallback from the Pick, Click, Give program?
Let's see if she can answer that question.
Mr. Chair, I will try to answer that question very briefly and quickly in the interest of your direction. The answer is that no, the incentive program that you're talking about does not come out of the 15%. It comes from private donations and private support. It is a program that incents our nonprofits to try to grow their marketing efforts and actively campaign to increased donor retention. So it is partly funded. Yes, we do give out $5,000 awards and $1,000 award to various nonprofits across the state that have achieved greatness in Pick, Click, Give each year. But it's not a part of the 15%. It comes from private funding.
Okay, thank you. And now we have Representative Guttenberg and then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kempin, you asked the question or made an assumption, but I'm going to ask it, I think, to the Rasmussen of the Furker folks here. And the Raven wants to know, you asked about a larger, deeper analysis of this program, but have you done a preliminary analysis of its impact on you to come up with an assumption where you should ask those questions? Do you know or feel that you know how badly it's going to impact you?
To the Chair, Representative, yes, to answer your question, we have not conducted thorough research on this, and I think that's exactly what we're asking, is that we would like to be involved in that research program and understand the implications that it could have on Pick, Click, Give and the other charitable ways of giving through your permanent fund dividend. And I think that is what specifically the ask of today, is that we just make sure we pause to take the time to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Let's go to Deborah Bitney. Are you online, Deborah?
I am online.
Good. I had you listed as here in the room, and I didn't see you. So would you go ahead and fill us in? First of all, put yourself on the record and go ahead with your testimony, and then we'll see if the committee has some questions.
Okay. Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me to testify today. For the record, my name is Deborah Bitney. I'm Vice President with the Rasmussen Foundation, and first let me thank you for your service and the important work you're doing for all Alaskans. We appreciate it. The Rasmussen Foundation spearheaded the implementation of Pick, Click, Give in 2007 to support the state's nonprofit sector and, more importantly, the people they serve. Rasmussen Foundation invested $3 million to implement Pick, Click, Give, and the first year alone, it was nearly $1 million cost. In its 10 years, Pick, Click, Give has raised approximately $20 million for nonprofit service providers across the state. My testimony today is regarding SB 78, which creates a voluntary deduction for a state lottery using the permanent fund dividend application with an effective date of January 1st, 2018. A lottery deduction will have a direct effect on the Pick, Click, Give program. SB 78 has moved very quickly through the legislature without sufficient time to assess the impact of the dividend application process, the nonprofit sector, or the people that it serves. In my capacity as director of the PFD division when Pick, Click, Give was created, I managed adding more features to the dividend application process. It requires time, resources, and extensive testing. I've seen firsthand how large-scale changes to the application can fail when mandated on short notice. When the application process fails, it has a direct negative impact on the programs associated with it, as well as having an additional burden on the department in fielding calls and emails from angry applicants. I urge the committee to allow sufficient time for the proposed program to be assessed for impact to the beneficiaries and to the system. Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have questions? Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when was the last time that a charitable organization was added?
And
Rep. Wilson, through the chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry. I'm working with the Rasmussen Foundation now and haven't been involved directly in Pick, Click, Give.
And we do have Elizabeth Ripley, chairman of the 4-Acre Group, or Nina Kemple, whoever would be best to answer that.
Chairman, to the chair, representative, I would answer the question of,
is this Ms.
be clear on the question of when was the last time the charitable organization was added to the list of organizations for Pick, Click, Give giving each year?
Yes, I think that was.
That is the question. In fact, every year it's updated. Each organization is required to fill out an application form and apply. They need to meet some minimum standards, including details that we don't have to get into today, but I can certainly provide the house details and how one gets added. But it's generally been growing at about 80 to 100 organizations a year. I think as a demonstration of the success of the program, and again, last year we had 688 organizations participate, and I think we have about the same amount that have applied for application for 2018.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
So the concern that we just heard as far as changing the application and how costly that is, it sounds like you're already doing that. So, I mean, Mike, did I hear that correctly?
To the chair, Representative Wilson, we are actually not actively changing the process. We are updating some modifications to our website and to the technology together with the state, but we're not actually modifying the process at all. The process is very well understood by the nonprofits who participate in it, and the process will continue in the same way that it happens in the past.
Clarification, Mr. Chairman.
Clarification, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I wasn't talking about the process. I was talking about the concern was by adding another charity or adding this program that would be really costly and it's hard to do. But what I understood you to say was that you're adding 60 people, 60 different organizations come a year, and everybody also has to be recertified. So that list is already being done yearly right now.
Representative Wilson, I think that the difference was adding another factor into the PFD application in that process, not just the list that goes through Pick, Click, Give. But we could get that. Let's see, the person that testified to that was, I think, Deborah Bitney, when she used to be at the PFD. Is that the testimony that I heard is that that was where the time should be spent for looking at to make sure IT doesn't crash and things.
This is Debbie again. Yes, that is correct.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that it wasn't the list once you're in the subgroup when you're in pick, click, give, but establishing another option in the permanent fund IT system was where the problem has come.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So,
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. So, let's say instead of this raffle sitting outside of pick, click, and give on its own separate little entity. So if I understand it correctly, if they were actually part of pick, click, and give, their own entity, they could still do the whole, you know, once they got the money, they were able to put it into the different buckets. You're telling me that that would be a much more affordable way of doing it versus them sitting outside on their own and then having to change perhaps a PFD form and a whole different computer program.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe that is accurate. Adding another whole different process to the application is my concern.
And one more follow-up.
Was that Deborah Bitney speaking? Just for the record here.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So besides the university, and I know they have different campuses, is there any other part of the state government that is currently part of Pick, Click, and Give?
And that would probably be for Mrs. Kemple.
Whoever knows the answer.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, currently you actually need to be a nonprofit organization to be part of Pick, Click, Give. We actually have no government organizations that are involved currently right now, but I with the exception of the university. With that said, I think your question is actually a very good one and exactly why we're asking us to actually stop and pause and give this further research and study on the best way for this to be set up. And I think due diligence on the side of Pick Click Give, as well as the state and Senator, the Senate bill is actually the important thing that we would like to recommend is that research is important.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Ms. Bitney, probably for you, since you've worked both at the Permanent Fund and now at the Rasmussen Foundation, I'm just curious about the cost of running this bill. Let's say it passes. We collect the money, we pay out money. I don't really know the details of how this would work, but have you thought at all about whether the estimated $275,000 administration cost is high, low, accurate? I can't tell.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, I am not as familiar with the $275,000 fiscal note. I saw a fiscal note for $8,000 that I thought was not accurate. I thought it was low. I do know that when you implement a new program and it involves the public, that you need a pretty robust system for dealing with questions, and I don't see that as part of the plan here, and I'm just curious myself as to how they would handle that.
And thank you. And we have Sarah Race here that can answer these questions. So if you...
It's not the fiscal note, really.
What's that?
Ms. Bidney was right. It's not the fiscal note. It's the part that comes out of the proceeds then goes to pay for administration. So.
But if you want a fiscal... note or a question on the administrative costs, then we can get Sarah Race up. Is that your question?
Yeah, whenever it's appropriate to ask her to come up.
Okay, and you're able to stay around for a while, aren't you? Okay, so let's go ahead. I don't know how. Let's get the other invited testimony, at least on the record, make sure that everybody's had a chance. And did we have Elizabeth Ripley?
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Hello.
Members of the House.
Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you're representing, and then go ahead with your introductory testimony.
My name is Elizabeth Ripley. Professionally, I serve as the CEO of the Madison Health Foundation, but today I speak in the capacity of chair of the 4-Acre Group's governance board. And the 4-Acre Group serves as the state nonprofit association for nonprofits and tribes across Alaska. We are dedicated to increasing the leadership and management skills of professionals and volunteers working in Alaska's nonprofit and tribal organizations through an innovative approach focused on our nonprofit sustainability model.
Well, great.
Everything we do is rooted in our commitment to meet nonprofits and tribes where they currently exist, working with them to foster new skills, collaborative partnerships, sustainability, and strategic thinking. And because our membership is broad, representing hundreds of different missions and clientele, we are decidedly and intentionally nonpartisan. We appreciate the invitation to talk about this PFD raffle bill today, and we thank you, the House Finance Committee, specifically for your support of Pickwick Give over the years. Representative Seaton sponsored the sustainability bill, and Representative Thomas sponsored the 3-year pilot bill that enabled launch of Pickwick Give. As Nina mentioned, the 4-Acre Group was part of a team of partners that successfully launched Pickwick Give program in 2008. And since its inception, Pickwick Give has helped raise $20 million from generous Alaskans for approximately 700 nonprofits statewide. And as many of you know, these donations have helped put food on the table for hungry children, provided support for the homeless, instruction in outdoor safety, therapeutic experiences for people suffering from disease, and comfort for people in hospice care. Just to name a few ways Pickwick Give has touched Alaskans. Pickwick Give has always had three goals. Number one, grow the number of individual Alaska donors. Number two, grow the amount of money people invest in their communities. And number three, raise awareness about the power of individual philanthropy in our state. And 4-Acre remains committed to those goals through Pickwick Give and other mechanisms. So Pickwick Give is a powerful tool in the nonprofit toolbox, and we know that it has inspired nonprofit leaders, boards, donors, and volunteers to engage in critical causes. Pickwick Give took years of study. The legislature didn't want to implement a program that would have unintended consequences or to complicate the works at the PFD division in terms of technology and potential calls from the public. So we wanted to know the consequences that we could not foresee without significant research in advance. I mean, in the end, the state legislature approved the initial PFD charitable contributions program as a 3-year pilot project, and then it became a law. It was a long process worth the journey to avoid unintended consequences. The groups that Nina mentioned, we were in constant contact with each other during the first years of implementation to really ensure that the process went smoothly as possible. All this to say, making a material change to the way the permanent fund dividend application functions might be far more complicated and require more hands on deck than it appears. So we're not sure that SB 78 is as simple as adding a button to an application. I do want to be clear, the 4-Acre Group is not here to oppose SB 78 at this time. We do simply urge the legislature to consider the value of conducting some analysis of the impact of adding a new feature onto the PFD dividend application process. And specifically, we are very concerned about the potential impact to the Pickwick Give participating nonprofits and their beneficiaries. Here are some things we'd like to know before implementation of a PFD raffle. Will a lottery option reduce the amount that Alaskans give to the nonprofit sector? What happens if the raffle checkoff is located within the dividend application and applicants are offered the option to make charitable donations only after the applicant has committed their entire dividend to the raffle? In other words, what order will the user see these options? Will a lottery option reduce the amount that Alaskans currently spend on other forms of charitable gaming, all of which have ties to nonprofits in Alaska, as the current gaming rules require? how will the lottery impact the technology improvements underway for PickClick Give? And while the advertising and promotion for the lottery will likely be less than that needed for PickClick Give, is the new $44,000 truly the cost of the program, including the Department of Revenue staff time, technology startup, and rollout? We believe this number is too low given our experience with this process. How will the communication differentiate itself from the PickClick Give process? And how will you explain this process to the public, given a very small fiscal note to fund the program in the first year? Is the Department of Revenue prepared to make the changes necessary for smooth implementation without jeopardizing the PickClick Give or UA College Savings Funds process? So those are some questions we think really need to be explored prior to this bill moving forward. And before closing, I would like to take a moment to note that the 4-Acre Group is separate and distinct from our other implementation partners. But we all came together to engage the Alaska State Legislature, many of you, the nonprofit sector, and the people of Alaska to make it easy to support the nonprofit causes that we care about. PickClick Give is really one of a kind across the country. We're proud of this program and the work of the legislature to create it. We're dedicated to preserving the program, and we urge the legislature to slow down and assess the potential unintended consequences. Thank you on behalf of the 4-Acre Group for this time to testify.
And thank you for your testimony. We have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So would you have the same concern about a button being put on there, which the income tax would also be part of the process as well? So wouldn't that also have a concern there, that people would be using their firm fund to pay their taxes versus to the charitable contributions?
I'm not familiar with that, Representative Wilson, through the chair.
Okay. Maybe I've just been spending way too much time here. Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So on page 4, lines 5 through 9, I'm pretty sure that answers the question as far as if somebody overpays, it does go to the charitable contributions over the raffle. So that's not a, hopefully that'll take care of that concern. So, but another question. So advertising always seems, you know, to really eat up a lot of costs. So you don't see any kind of gain that there's somebody else out there that would be, you know, talking about another reason that they could give and may actually, depend upon how, you know, like you said, where they put it on the form, that it could actually add more people being more aware of PickClick and Give?
I mean, I think that it's possible that that advertising could be coordinated. However, some of that advertising is funded separate from the administrative fee. I think Nina could go more into that. But, for instance, the Mental Health Foundation has provided funding that's matched by local nonprofits in MATSU to specifically highlight MATSU nonprofits. So there's different levels of advertising. Part of that developing philanthropy focus is helping the nonprofits engage and learn how to do better donor development and advertising and work that piece. So there's sort of many facets of the PickClick Give program. And so I don't know how that would coordinate or who would pay for the raffle advertising.
And, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to get down the weeds and to do it. My point's just sometimes the more advertising that there is can a lot of times raise the level of awareness, and having something new like that may actually gain more people to understand PickClick and give more to charity as you're also looking at the education portion.
And Representative Wilson, I think that what some of the testifiers have been saying is how are these going to interact, and how are the what are the consequences of having these two programs? They might be positive, they might not, and without having some study, it's hard to tell other than just throwing a dart at the board and saying, oh, it will or it won't.
But Mr. Chairman, don't we have the same problem with ASME and tourism? I mean, I think that discussion at this table, as far as coordinating their efforts together, having two groups separately out there who could actually bumping each other up, has almost been competitive. So I'm not sure what kind of study and I guess that's where I'm lost, what kind of study we could have to figure out how people are going to react to anything in this state.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, the last comments there by the previous speaker, it's kind of what I'm thinking. In terms of, because of the uniqueness of the permanent fund and the uniqueness of Pick, Click, and Give, one of you spoke that it's a program, one of a kind here in the United States, and I think there's very few states that have a dividend. Is there a way, do you guys feel confident that there's a way that we could actually study this and get some meaningful results? And I guess that question is for anybody out there.
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, this is Elizabeth Ripley speaking. I mean, I think that we would like to have a lot more communication about SB 78 and see if we could work through some of these concerns and take some time to do that.
Thank you.
And Representative Ortiz, just from my standpoint, I have no idea whether you can, whether there's examples around the country when they started a Powerball or when they started a lottery, what were the effects of, were donations to nonprofits, not through a permanent fund dividend, but did, you know, those are things that could be looked at, and I don't know what those effects are. Maybe we're saying that if there was a Powerball lottery, donations went up to nonprofits in the community, or maybe they went down. You know, those are things that might be able to be found. We do have public testimony, so are there any other questions at this time for the invited testifiers? So let's go to public testimony, and would you please try to limit your public testimony to 2 minutes? And we will remember that we have Sarah Race here that can answer some of those other questions, but I'd like to get to the people online. So let's go to Soldaten and Daniel Lynch. Are you there?
I am, sir, and thank you for the time. Daniel Lynch speaking for myself. I'll try to go real fast here. I found it very interesting listening to Mr. Madoff's presentation. He did not mention if I have raffle tickets that are losers, if I can write that off my federal taxes as a charity to the state. Well, I really came over here, though, I can take the opportunity to compliment the House for actually attempting to find real solutions and solve problems that the state is facing. I've heard Senate leadership and the media poo-poo the House for suggesting that income tax and education funding cannot be combined because of the dedicated fund issue. Now I see this bill, SB 78, is a bill supporting education dedicated per se. This bill is no more than a gimmick or a diversion, and you will, if you will, from solving real problems. The Senate reminds me of a circus clowns who juggle shiny balls and bowling pins to distract us from any real solutions. Before I moved to this great state, I resided in a Midwestern state that started lottery to fund education in the mid-70s. That state had probably 20 to 25% bigger population at about one-fifth the landmass area to distribute the lotto tickets at all the terminals in convenience and liquor stores, the daily three, daily four, etc., etc. That model would never be profitable with this state's population and landmass. However, there is a potential in casinos, limited casinos. If the state received 25% of profits, borough municipality 25% of profits, and the operator 50% of profits, that would create employment and diversification, plus with new revenue and income tax for these employees. The way the sponsor has it, there's nothing that is diversification. It's only moving money around. Kenai has emptied Lowe's building, Anchorage has empty Sports Authority buildings, etc., which would be perfect Alaska casinos. SB 78 is a gimmick, a diversion, and a joke. It should be treated as such. And as I said, I'm from the Midwest, and I know what manure smells like. It smells like SB 78. Well, thank you for your time and consideration, and if you happen to see the governor, tell him I have 10 or 11 raffle tickets coming from this year's PFD. Just go ahead and slip them in the mail. Thank you.
Thank you. We will figure out how to turn this off here. Thank you for your testimony. Were there any questions for Daniel? Seeing none, let's Joy Stewart, are you on there to testify?
I am.
Oh, welcome. Would you put yourself on the record and go ahead with your 2-minute testimony?
Certainly. For the record, my name is Joyce Stewart, and good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to address the House Finance Committee. I'm speaking as an individual, but I am the director of a nonprofit here in Homer, and we have not had the opportunity to address this issue as a board, so I'm not speaking on their behalf. But I also serve on the statewide board for the nonprofit, the 4-Acre Group. And I do have concerns about Senate Bill 78, the PFD lottery. The 4-Acre Group has a mission to strengthen Alaskan's nonprofit sector. An important part of 4-Acre's model for organizational sustainability is for nonprofits to have access to adequate unrestricted funds to support their missions. Over the last many years, I've seen Pick, Click, Give become an important tool for Alaskan nonprofits, including my organization, to raise unrestricted funds and to make connections with new donors. And I think that's really a critical point because of the statewide outreach and the marketing for Pick, Click, Give. I've actually garnered donors from outside of my area, and that's very important to my organization. I do applaud all legislators that are working hard and coming up with creative ideas to help balance the state's budget, and I'm absolutely in support of finding a way to forward fund education. However, there's been very little study on the impact that the PFD lottery could have on Pick, Click, Give. It would be a terrible shame to jeopardize this successful program without doing adequate thought into the impact on the state's charitable sector if the residents are given an option to allocate their dividend towards the lottery. I think Elizabeth Riffley, the chair of the 4-Acre Governance Board, gave some really key concerns, and I hope you find a way to communicate together with the 4-Acre and others. I do thank you. It's not that we're against this lottery idea. It's just we really want to know that we can make it continue to work for Pick, Click, Give, which is already a proven successful way of generating unrestricted funds for nonprofits. Thank you.
And thank you. Does anybody have a question? Let's go to Tammy Smith. Tammy Smith in Anchorage, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, I am Tammy Smith. I am from Fairbanks. Hello to all the Fairbanks legislators down there. And I teach at Barnett Elementary School in Fairbanks. I've been a teacher for 36 years. I am currently serving as the NEA Director for NEA Alaska. And recently, at our NEA Alaska Board of Directors, we had very similar debates, and we ended up supporting SB 78. We feel that it is a way to supplement, not supplant, public funding for education. Since the beginning of Alaska's fiscal crisis, we have advocated for a comprehensive fiscal solution that will address the state's budget deficit and prevent further cuts to public education. In the short term, SB 78 is not a solution to the fiscal crisis, but a viable supplement to existing sources of revenue for K-12 education. Every year, educators face great uncertainty about what the next year's school funding budget will be. That budget uncertainty is a negative impact for all of our students, and it makes it difficult for educators to prepare Alaska students for the college and career readiness, and lifelong success. Just today, I got an email from our superintendent who said non-tenure teachers can expect to receive layoff notices as of April 28th. Well, that's today. So today, teachers are expecting to receive layoff notices, and that's for our non-tenure teachers, and our tenure teachers will be expecting layoff notices by May 12th. Further, our support staff will be given a 10-day notice when they will be laid off. That's very harmful to our students. What we are seeking is a long-term solution to this problem. Over the long term, with this innovative approach to a creative education endowment fund that will grow over time and a dedicated revenue stream of donations for public education, SB 78 could someday help to end the annual budget uncertainty our school districts continue to face. With Alaska facing a $3 billion budget deficit, SB 78 is not the solution to today's K-12 funding shortfalls in Alaska, we continue to urge the legislature to reverse the $69 million cut to education funding that was proposed by the Senate and to pass a comprehensive fiscal plan this year, which includes restructuring the permanent fund earnings reserve and the enactment of a new broad-based revenue source to close the fiscal gap. We support the House's recent action to pass HB 115, the Education Funding Act. We view Senate Bill 78 as a supplement to those efforts, not to supplant. Again, I thank the committee for all the time that they have put into this effort. We look again for 1,000 streams of income, and this is one way we can do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy. Are there questions? Seeing none, we have Bill Wright in Fairbanks.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Finance Committee. My name is Bill Wright, for the record. I am speaking as an individual, but I am also a member of the 4-Acre Operations Board and the Executive Director of United Way of the Tanana Valley. And as a charitable nonprofit here in the Fairbanks area, I just wanted to let you know that we rely on the unrestricted funds of Pick, Click, Give, as do 21 other essential health and social service agencies here in Fairbanks. And those unrestricted funds are very important to us because some nonprofits, including ours, receive funds that have specific designations. When we get funding from Pick, Click, Give, those funds are available to use at our discretion, and where they're much needed, they could be used to keep our lights on, they could be used to pay for our heating bills, rent, and things like that that perhaps other funding doesn't cover. So we rely on that as a very important part of the Pick, Click, Give program. We also rely on the connections that we make with the donors through the Pick, Click, Give program. We've seen that number of people grow over the years that we've been involved. The agencies that we are part of members of the United Way also have seen their numbers grow, and they build those lifelong connections with community members. And it is an excellent opportunity as well to work with children and let the children see and learn about philanthropy. And to us, that is a very, very important part of our mission to inspire giving and philanthropy here in the Tanana Valley. Just like the others have said so far today, we really want to make sure that you understand that we're not against the raffle. We're not against Senate Bill 78. We really would like to see some further study, further research on the impact this might have on the Pick, Click, Give program. And that's mostly what I wanted to say, but I did want to add to that. Thank you very much for the work you guys are doing down there in Juneau. I know that the word on the street sometimes is that you're not getting work done, but it's very clear to me today to see that you are all trying to be creative, trying to work our way out of this, and I commend you for that. Thank you for your time today.
And thank you and for the testimony. And does anybody have any questions? So we have one more person online. That's Mike Coons in Palmer. Are you there?
Yes, this is Mike Coons calling. You hear me?
Yes, we can. Would you go ahead with your up to 2-minute testimony?
Okay. I'm Mike Coons. I'm calling from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. First of all, this is going to have a huge impact on seniors and senior programs that are in Click Give. My wife works for a nonprofit here in Palmer dealing with seniors, and it's going to have a huge impact on them. And Representative Wilson, you hit it right on the nail head when you brought up the point that, you know, when it comes down to, oh, gee, my tax is going to be $954, and I'm only going to get a $1,250 PFD. Oh, guess what? Any chances of going into any charity just goes out the window because I need that $954 to pay for my tax. I think you were absolutely spot on, Tammy, just absolutely spot on. If I did this, I would try to take off taxes, and if I did this, and the question was raised, I think somebody, about could you cut off as a gambling loss in the feds, not in the federal income tax? I don't gamble. But if I were to try to do this and I didn't win, I wonder if that would be write off as a gambling loss. I oppose this bill as well as because I oppose the income tax, which is not by law an education tax. You can call it that all you want to, Representative, but it is not an education tax. It's an income tax. By the way, I have no kids, and so I don't have to have, so those that have kids should be paying for that education tax. Well, ensuring that their kids have zero, while they're doing that, their kids are going to have zero funds for their higher education, whatever that may be. Also, I was stationed in Ohio, and I said we had the Ohio lottery down there, which was a complete lie, because they told all the people in Ohio that 90% of that money was going to go into education. It was more like 10%. So this is, that they lied, so I'm kind of getting a pretty good idea that this is nothing more than a lie. And lastly, I commend the House minority for standing tall and standing against the income tax, and I stand tall, and I hope that they also believe that they will stand tall against this abomination of stupidity on a lottery. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mike. And I don't see any questions. Let's go to the room. Is there anyone in the room that wants to testify on House or Senate Bill 78? Seeing none, is there anyone else online? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. And we'll come back to the committee to are there questions? This time. Yes, Representative Wilson.
So is this appropriate time to bring Ms. Race up?
Yes. Welcome to House Finance. You
have the deal. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Sarah Race, the Permanent Fund Dividend Division Director.
Representative Wilson.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm a little confused on the pick, click, and give, or on this one, either one. And so will you be the one who does pick, click, and give as far as the setup and where the money goes? And will you also have the same responsibility if this were to be started with the permanent fund?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we do have a part of the administration procedures that happen with the pick, click, give program now. And as far as this program goes, we would be adding an additional question to the application that would allow an individual to participate in the raffle, and they would be able to select in $100 increments. And then from that, when the individual becomes eligible and paid, this would be the last priority order item to pay out. And if there wasn't a $100 increment available to pay, the portion would go back to the applicant.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
So one of the concerns that we heard was that this would be costly to have this added onto the PFD application. Do you have any idea of how much you think that would be?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the fiscal note that I put forth is $8,000 for programming costs. Because most of the infrastructure is already built in there, we would be adding a question to the application as well as creating what we in our world call a vendor in our vendor table. So as an individual's payment goes through all non-voluntary deductions and then through voluntary deductions, this becomes one of those slots in that spot.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
So this program, as well as the pick, click, and give, do you know how much the administration, how much your department does as far as, because you did say there was some administration in the portion on the pick, click, and give. Can you tell me how much that is and how much you would anticipate an ongoing cost would be if this program were to be put in?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we have the one-time implementation costs after really putting the additional question on the application and creating the reports that we would need every single year. That would be an additional question on the application, and that point forward would be a pretty similar process. We would have advertising costs in the first year because money isn't available. We are going to have to use creative solutions, you know, Facebook, websites, other state agencies, any way that we possibly can. Typically, when people are talking about the permanent fund application filing season, we get a lot of press in general. And then in the following year, 2% of the funds collected are available for advertising costs. So at that point in time, if we wanted to do additional advertising, we would have that fund available.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
But I thought you said that there was there was accounting costs to the Pick, Click, and Give right now that you now take care of. So do you know what that amount is?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Yes, we do have costs that are associated with it. They're not costs that come directly from the state. When a participating organization wants to participate in the Pick, Click, Give program, tongue twister there, they have a $250 application fee. That $250 application fee goes into an account that we have that has a rolling balance that we have available. And so the programming costs that we use, because, as you mentioned before, organizations change, the structure in Pick, Click, Give is a bit dynamic. We have one-third of one of our programmers' salaries associated to that, which comes out of that fund. And then we also have United Way as a vendor that is the vendor that actually vets all of those applications and does that process. So essentially, the state, we collect the data on the application, and then once we have all of the organizations that individuals have donated X amount to, we send that information to United Way as a vendor that works for us, and then they're the ones that sparse out those payments to the different organizations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And one question with advertising and administration of this, is that coming to you to do? I mean, if you're not going to get the $250 application fee, you're not going to have a rolling fund to take that out of for this program. So are you going to be responsible for the advertising, and are you going to be responsible for the administration of the raffle section?
Mr. Chairman, and that is why I said in the first year we're going to have to use those more creative aspects for advertising, and then going forward as the money is collected, 2% is dedicated towards advertising or administration.
And is that money that's going to pay for personnel at your division, or is the division going to absorb that within your personnel and just use the money for the advertising itself?
Mr. Chairman, at this point in time, we don't see any additional personnel needed. It would be advertising, and as far as administrative costs that may go into the investment portion of it, I can't speak to that. Scott Jones might be able to speak to that a little bit further if you have further questions on that.
Okay, and we can have him back when we take the bill up again. We do have another bill before us, and we have some invited testimony. So I think that unless anybody has any further questions right now, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. And thank you for coming. Thanks for the sponsor for being here to run through the first round of questions here, understanding this bill. And let's go to it's House Bill 105, and if we could have the sponsor come up.
Do we have 2 minutes?
Sure.
How long?
Just two.
2 minutes? Oh, okay, we're going to take a 2 minute out of these. It's really going to be.
Really? Yeah.
It's really going to be 3 minutes. Welcome. We're back on record, and we have House Bill 105. And welcome to House Finance. Would you put yourselves on the record and go ahead and introduce the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andy Josephson. I represent District 17 in Anchorage.
For the record, I'm Tom Atkinson. I'm staff to Representative Josephson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be relatively brief. I think my opening statement might be somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 minutes, and then I have invited testimony. Just some background on this bill. This bill is a bill that would create a closure on the hunting and trapping of wolves in an area typically called the Stampede Trail, which is the sort of rectangular section you see at the top northeast corner of Denali National Park, although the Stampede Trail is not Denali National Park. And then it would also create a closure to the east of the park's highway in an area commonly referred to as the Nanana Canyon, although invited testimony may offer other descriptors of it as well. The reason or the catalyst for this bill is several things. There was a policy of the state that dated back at least to 1992, if not before, that wolves in Denali National Park were a particular treasure, both in terms of their ecological importance, but also their economic importance. And at various times, and frankly more often than not, is sort of my sense, but Dr. Steiner will give you a better sense of it, through around, into the Palin administration, I would say approximately, there were protections afforded for wolves that crossed out of federal land and into state land. And I want to be clear at this point, this is not about surrendering any land to the federal government. This would be the state of Alaska, as a matter of policy, saying we're going to close some areas to hunting and trapping of wolves. But getting back to the bill itself, what's happened is, starting for sure in 2010, what was commonly called the wolf buffer ended. And in fact, the Board of Game, for a period, I believe, of 6 years, put a moratorium on any consideration of continuing the buffer. And the history of the buffer is a little odd in that there was a time, and Dr. Steiner can talk about this too, where there was actually a proposal request to expand the sort of protective zone. And even though that was the policy or proposal before the Board of Game, they actually went the opposite direction at the same time and removed this wolf buffer altogether. The bill was originally filed by me in 2013. It originally created a special management area, which means that the Department of Natural Resources would administer the bill, effectively. And we then toyed with the idea of a critical habitat area instead, this very session. But the Department of Fish and Game, which has not said to me, we roundly endorse this bill, nor have they, I think they're officially neutral on the bill. But they have indicated that the best way to do this, and I have an email that reflects this, is with just a closure. And one of the benefits of a closure is you don't get into, frankly, anxiety and concerns about mixed-use areas. There's some university land in this area. There's railroad land. There is a municipality, at least one, that is Healy, I think, is in this area. And sort of get away from those complications and you just get into the closure. Now let me talk about why we were requesting a closure. The Denali National Park, as I understand it, is the third highest revenue generating park in the country. There are 650,000 visitors per year. Spending at the park is about $810 million. And anyone who's driven just north of there knows that there is virtually a small city of hotels and commerce north of the park entrance and really south of the park entrance. The park, tourism generally in the state creates 19,000 jobs that produce nearly $1 billion in wages, principally during the summer. And it's my position, and not just my position, you have data from, for example, Eco Northwest that Dr. Steiner will talk about, that the value of Denali's wolves is greater as a tourism interest than it is as a hunting or trapping interest. Let me note about the comparative value. What we're told, and no one has, I want to be clear about this, no one has testified that this statement that I'm about to make is incorrect. What we're told is that about 2 to 3 trappers are involved in trapping these wolves. Notoriously, and I would say infamously, there was a story just 14 months ago in National Geographic where one of them, Coke Wallace, who's sort of infamous, was asked about his practice, and he said, if I can just read a little very briefly from National Geographic magazine, well, for example, he was interviewed, and some of this is bravado, and you know, I think we've all exercised some bravado from time to time. But he said he saw some people coming over to look at or track some wolves, and he said, we thought maybe you guys were radio tracking a wolf. I almost went over to see if there was anything I could shoot. But more infamously, he said, referring to the Grant Creek Pack, he said that, quote, that was the third time I ruined millions of people's Denali National Park viewing experience, close quote. And the story, and I think you might have this, it might be in Basis, I think we provided it to you, includes photographs of the wolves that were Denali wolves that he took. And what we know is that the Grand Creek and East Fork packs have been, I believe at least one of them is outright sort of gone. And one of them is the most studied wildlife packs of its kind in the world. It fundamentally doesn't exist, and Dr. Steiner will give you more information about that. We know that there's data that as recently as the early 90s, there were, oh, they estimated 160 wolves, maybe 159 wolves in the area, and as recently as last year, that number was down into, I believe, the 50s. We also know that visitors to the park, and no one's contested this, no one said this is wrong, these bus drivers have the surveys wrong, visitors used to see wolves 45% of the time, they now see wolves 6% of the time. And I think that the economic value is just tremendous. The other thing that this relates to, frankly, is that efforts to sort of democratize this concern by going to the Board of Game have fallen on deaf ears. So, for example, in February, late February, the Board of Game heard proposal 142. I believe that's the number. The Board of Game, and I provided most of these to the committee, was inundated with hundreds of letters saying, please protect these wolves, speaking both to the ecological and economic value. The letters came from Alaskans, and they came from out of state. Meanwhile, by the way, as an aside, I suspect since we left the floor, there's 10 more letters of support that I forwarded to the committee, and I apologize to Ms. Pearson for having inundated her with those. But there are, I suspect I've gotten over 50, close to 75 letters of support. There are a handful of letters in opposition. And but back to the Board of Game. The Board of Game heard this testimony in late February, and they voted 7-0 against. Now, this committee may say, well, you know, those are very smart men and women. They must know something. I'm not saying that they're not smart men and women. What I am saying is that they are, there is no longer a member of the Board of Game like Ben Grusendorf or Joel Bennett or Vic Van Valenberg or Bob Churchill or Tom Meacham. There isn't anyone there for a non-consumptive tourist wildlife watcher interest to go to and say, you really need to hear my concerns. And I'm not saying that they don't hear the concerns. I'm saying that ultimately they dismiss those concerns. And in fact, they often dismiss those concerns by saying, well, look, the wolves leave federal land, that ain't my problem. I mean, that's essentially part, I mean, it's a, they have a more sophisticated response than that, but that's part of what they say. And what I'm suggesting to the committee is that there's an economic interest in Alaskans in protecting these wolves. And, you know, I would also note that I'm told that about 85% of Alaskans don't trap and hunt. They don't do that. And by the way, south of the mountain itself, that is south of Denali Peak, where there's a lot of preserve land, and there's preserve land to the west as well, there is, under Anilka, the opportunity to trap wolves and hunt wolves. There's all sorts of sport hunting that goes on. This has been a subject of dispute in the last month under a Don Young-sponsored resolution. But nonetheless, there has been and there continues to be sport hunting and subsistence hunting that goes on in Denali. But what makes this unique is that this is the place the regular, I'll put that in quote, tourists can access wolves by using the park road. And these tourists go back to the lower 48 and they say, you know what they say. They say, we saw this many bears. Did you see wolves? They're asked. We didn't see wolves. Are there wolves there? I'm sure they're asked. I don't know if they know. But most of them, apparently 94%, don't see wolves. This is the place. This is the place to cheaply and sort of hopefully see a wolf. The other thing I would note, just for the record, is there is a woman who's been active in trapping issues in the Matsu Valley. She's been written about many times, both in the Frontiersman and the Dispatch News, named Lynn Mitchell. And Lynn Mitchell did a bunch of research on how often the Board of Game entertains and passes proposals that are non-consumptive. She found that 95% of the time they reject those proposals. When Al Barrett, who used to be on the Board of Game and lives in the Fairbanks area and testifies on these matters, he sent me an email saying, that sounds about right. So that figure was corroborated by somebody who had been on the Board of Game, doesn't see these issues the way I do. And just a couple other thoughts, and then I will retreat unless there are questions. The Fairbanks North Star Borough, in a vote of 6-3, passed a resolution, I think, like late last year. I think you have it or I can get it for you. 6-3 saying, stop trapping and hunting in these two areas, the Stampede Trail and the Nana Canyon. And, in fact, they wanted closure for wolverine, I think it is, and for brown bear. And those issues are actually related in that there is brown bear baiting that goes on in the area, and wolves are attracted to that. So, I mean, one might ask why I wasn't more expansive in my proposal. And let me just see if there's anything else I want to make sure to convey, and I'm just going to look at a couple things here. There is a history of the legislature engaging in some closures. The legislature, you know, we have the authority over Title 16. We have delegated and deferred to the Board of Game like nobody's business. They are plenary in their power. It's absolute. But there's nothing that says under Title 16 we can't modify that. We've modified it with critical habitat areas and sanctuaries. And there is some evidence that we've also modified, admittedly not extensive, but some, that we've modified it with closures as well. And I think those are the principal things I wanted to take up in my opening statement.
Good. Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we have a map in the
yes.
And now is the proposal in your bill to be the blue area then?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay. And then through the chair, why this proposed blue area and not the original 92 black checker mark area?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I'm going to let Dr. Steiner talk about that. He did in resources by telephone. He's here physically here in the room. And I think what he might testify is that you will let him testify.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there further questions? Let's make sure we get your invited testimony
yes.
on the record. if we can have you back.
Sure.
So I believe now we have Professor Steiner. Would you come forward and put yourself on the record? And by the way, we also have online for questions Bruce Dale with Division of Wildlife Conservation, Major Bernard Chasen, Deputy Director, Division of Wildlife Troopers. And so go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much. Rick Steiner. I was a professor with the University of Alaska in conservation biology for 30 years, stationed in various places around the state, and now I'm a consultant and conservation biologist. This legislature has many, many different complex issues you are dealing with at present, and I sympathize with you, and I also thank all of you for your service. It's Herculean, so thank you. But this bill is not one of your more important, difficult decisions, in my view. I think this should be one of the easiest decisions you have. In fact, some of us are wondering why this bill is even in Finance Committee, because there is no fiscal note whatsoever. It's no cost and a lot of money gained to the state if it's adopted. This should be, in my view, an easy yes. Get it out of committee. Get it to the floor for a vote. Let the debate occur. There's three major reasons. One, I've just mentioned one, it's a strong economic boom to the state at no cost. I'll discuss that briefly. I'll try to be as brief as possible. Secondly, it's consistent with the state constitution, which the management adjacent to Denali right now is not allocating these animals to two or three Alaska citizens over 70,000 Alaskan citizens that will visit Denali this summer, hoping to see these very same animals that have been allocated to two or three local individuals to be killed. That is very disproportionate, and it does not comport with the state constitution that requires common access to all resources and that wildlife is to be managed for the maximum benefit of the people, quote out of the Constitution. And thirdly, it's overwhelmingly publicly supported, this bill, this effort. It has been a matter of record for many, many years to the Board of Game, the Department of Fish and Game, and even previously to the legislature, and certainly to the Park Service, that the Alaska public overwhelmingly supports a closure, a permanent closure, adjacent to Denali National Park to boost visitor viewing success of wolves and other wildlife. The northeast boundary issue for wildlife has been an issue for 100 years, ever since the park was initially formed. And you have an opportunity here to try to end that issue, that controversy, this year, this session. The buffer was removed, as Representative Josephson stated, in 2010, and since then, visitor viewing success has plummeted from 45% to only 5% last year. If you do the math, that's about 250,000 people, visitors, paying visitors, were deprived the opportunity simply to see wolves in the wild in Denali National Park as a result of the state's removal of the protective buffer. That's a pretty insane way to manage any economy, in my view. The other thing, the science, I've submitted a number of documents, including my written testimony, some scientific papers that the federal government has produced on the impacts of the buffer. The buffer basically increases viewability of wolves along the in the park road. In answer to Representative Kawasaki's question, the reason that only the blue area is being requested is that original buffer that the Board of Game established was large. It included the southeast boundary of Denali, but the focus here is on viewability of wolves along the park road. So if you look at the park, I mean, it would be great to get a larger buffer from a wildlife conservation standpoint, but if we're focused specifically on viewability of wolves along the road, it's the blue area that would get us there. The economics, as Representative Josephson mentioned, this is in my testimony, wildlife viewing is a $2.7 billion a year industry, wildlife viewing, twice the economic impact as consumptive use, hunting and trapping in Alaska. And for many visitors who do not venture far from the road system, Denali is the best place to view terrestrial wildlife. It's easy. The economic value of Denali wildlife is enormous, and it dwarfs the economic value of hunting and trapping these animals. Again, 70,000 Alaska citizens, not to mention the 600,000 outside visitors that will come to Denali this summer, but the 70,000 Alaskans that will visit Denali have a right to these animals as much or more than the two or three individuals that have been allocated these animals through the Board of Game process. So, I mean, the math is pretty simple. Denali is really our number one or one of our top tourism economic assets in this state. It is the goose that lays the golden eggs. And why would we do anything but try to enhance and build that resource? And what the state has unfortunately been doing is the other. And some of this is some ideological animus towards the federal government, towards the park's existence in the very first place. And that's not a very rational way to manage an economic asset such as Denali National Park. One comparison, which is an interesting one, is Yellowstone National Park in Montana and Wyoming. They reintroduced wolves there after they were exterminated. They reintroduced them 20 or 30 years ago. And now Yellowstone is only about 2 million acres. Denali is 6 million acres. Yellowstone has twice as many wolves as Denali does, thus a much higher wolf density in the park. Visitor viewing success of wolves in Yellowstone is about 45% to 85%. So you have a pretty good chance, being a visitor to Yellowstone, of seeing wolves in the wild. There's been economic studies that value that at about $35 million a year, just wolf viewing in Yellowstone National Park. Imagine if this bill were to pass, and hopefully it will, wolf viewing in Denali will recover. There's no question about it. Right along the road system, tourism interests can start billing wolf viewing tours along the road system. The family group integrity will recover. They'll start denning and pupping right near the road system where they used to. And I think it's an economic plus. It's kind of, you know, there's very few things as close to a no-brainer as this bill, in my view, from a scientific, economic, political, and legal standpoint. Finally, on the issue of public support, this issue has received literally thousands of letters and emails and phone calls and protests and in support of. And there are some pockets of special interests that object to the notion of a Denali wolf buffer. Largely those are derived from an animus towards the park in the first place and towards federal overreach. I would respectfully encourage those who lean no on these kinds of issues to sort of take this issue out of that context and just look at it for what it is. This is basically, you know, Department of Fish and Game estimates that there's maybe four or five wolves taken annually in this area of the buffer that we're asking to be protected. That's not very many, but if one of those is a significant breeding individual in a family group, such as the Grant Creek Pack or the East Fork Toklat Pack, that loss can cause the disintegration of the entire family group, and that is what has happened both in 2012 and in 2015. There's an online petition with 330,000 signatures on it to date, a little bit more than that, asking for this buffer to be restored. The Fairbanks North Star Borough, it is in your packet. I did submit it along with the other documents. You should have that. Clearly, this to me, it's a very simple issue. I would simply ask that this committee, I know you normally don't pass bills out on your first hearing, but I would suggest you get this bill out of committee, get it moving to the House floor, and get on with your other very serious business. And if there's any questions, I would be delighted to try to answer them.
Questions? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We talked about how the buffer went away around 2010.
Right.
Were you in the area then, and were you aware of the reasoning, the logic for that decision? In other words, was it they were beginning to build to such a high level that they're having a negative impact on the other game in the area, or what was the issue?
Well, it's complicated, but I think it simply derives from an ideological animus towards the Park Service, towards the federal government. This is amongst the Board of Game and many interest groups that are very engaged with the Board of Game. And I understand that. I mean, the feds don't always get it right, right? However, this, as Representative Josephson mentioned, that particular Board of Game meeting, there were several, there were at least four, maybe five proposals from citizens groups asking that the existing buffer, which was in place from 2000 to 2010, be expanded because it was too small. Even some years with that buffer in place, the small one, there were as many as 19 park wolves. 15 to 20% of the total park population was killed after they crossed the buffer out into the exposed area near Healy and further out in the Stampede. So that existing buffer was too small. People proposed various expansions, and the board declined every single expansion proposal, eliminated the existing small buffer, which was pretty malevolent, we all felt. And then, on top of that, imposed a six-year moratorium on even considering any other Denali buffer proposals, which I feel was legally questionable at best. The board is constituted with hearing citizen proposals. I just think the other thing is the Board of Game, even if it were to establish a legitimate, authentic, sufficiently sized buffer, it could turn around the next month and do away with it. And this, we know this, this is exactly what happened with the first buffer they put in 1992. They established on that map there the 811 square mile buffer in 1992. And then this is the very same year then that Wally Hickel, Governor Hickel, terminated some of the predator control programs in response to a potential tourism boycott that had been organized by national tourism groups, and then in response, in retaliation to Governor Hickel's cancellation of these IM programs, the board eliminated the buffer 2 months after they established it. So there's no consistency there. The board cannot establish something permanently. The legislature can. So I hope that is responsive to your question.
Just more comment than anything. I come from southern southeast Alaska, and I can certainly speak to the economic value of tourism and wildlife viewing. I mean, that has a much bigger impact on our economy than the hunting aspect of it does. So anyway,
Mr. Chair, on that,
the numbers support that.
And Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is my district for 10 years. And when the board made that decision to get rid of the buffer zones, had nothing to do with biological certainty.
It was a through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, you're absolutely correct. Anybody that observed the Board of Game process and on this specific issue knows that the Denali Wolf issue is a political pawn in their process. Thank you.
Are there further questions? Representative Gehr.
Thank you. Professor Steiner, so the opposition letters largely focus on the impact this would have on subsistence hunting and other hunting. So what's your response to that?
It's not a subsistence hunt. The trapping and hunting of wolves in this area is pure, the terminology is non-subsistence, it's sport. Through the chair, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I think what they meant is more wolves, less moose. That's probably what they meant in their writing.
Through the chair, my understanding from Denali National Park wildlife biologists is that one of their problems is they have too many moose. They have complained about the high number of moose in the area. So, and this is a 340,000 acre area that would be closed. It's important to recognize that most of the moose hunting in the area takes place east of there anyway, in the Yanert. I mean, Representative Guttenberg would know this better than I. But all the area to the north, to the east, and to the south would remain accessible even for wolf hunting and trapping. So I understand that there's some small concern about that, but on balance, the millions of dollars that would be earned to the tourism businesses based on or set against the two or three that would be moved from this area and their wolf trapping and hunting, I think the balance is pretty clear.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, let's go see. We have Sean, Sean McGuire, and then I did want to let everybody know that we do have Deputy Director of the Troopers and Director of Wildlife Conservation online.
So, okay, Sean McGuire, I'm representing Alaskans for Wildlife. Live in Fairbanks, 159 Niffin Road. Appreciate the time here that you guys are giving us. Rick went over a lot of the stuff I have, but I want to maybe talk a little bit about some of the stuff. You know, when he says Denali is the crown jewel of Alaska, yeah, it is incredible. This is a world-class resource. I ran a bed and breakfast in Fairbanks for 15 years, and I can tell you it is such a powerful draw. People come to Fairbanks, they go down to Denali, they come back, they get on the computer, and they send those pictures back to their friends, Facebook, other email. They are thrilled. There's only basically two places in the entire nation where people have a chance to see wild wolves, and one of them is Denali. That's an incredible marketing. They get on the same day that they saw the wolf in the morning, and they're sending out pictures. So that is something that, you know, people are really thrilled. Basically, they come to Denali to see two things. They come to see the mountain, and they come to see the wildlife, bears and wolves. That's what they want to see. Everything else is, you know, icing on the cake. The other thing I wanted to expand on a little bit is the corridor. People talk about, well, there's a rectangle shape. If you look at the map, it's a long, skinny corridor. It goes into the park 24 miles, and it's 5 miles wide. So you've got a long, skinny corridor going deep into the park. For all practical purposes, it's the park on three sides. It is the park. It's the park. This is like, you know, really a bad land management situation where you've got this skinny corridor that goes deep into the heart of Denali National Park. This idea that a handful of people can go in there, and they're not just hunting or trapping, they are baiting the wolves out of the park. The park, these wolves can smell, and bears, they can smell one part per million. What these guys do is they go in and they put dead animals, dead pigs. This one guy actually shot a horse, left it right, they put it right on the boundary. And when those wolves, who, by the way, are relatively tame, they're not afraid of humans, they see humans all the time, they're not cautious, when they take one step over that line, boom, they're dead. And it's just a brutal, it is, are you kidding me? We're going to continue to allow these guys to bait these animals, these world-class, iconic animals out of the park? I mean, it is, in my opinion, it's a huge scandal. As far as, you know, the opposition to this, there was over 50 letters to the editor last year. 50 letters to the editor. I think there might have been one that I saw that people still saying, oh yeah, let's kill the wolves. So there's 50 letters saying, please stop this. People hate this. And one letter saying, yeah, let's keep killing those wolves, the Denali wolves. The Toklat pack, it was the most famous pack in world history. Certainly the most photographed pack in world history. Studied for over 70 years. And you're going to allow literally one or two people to go in and kill those wolves with bait, bait them out of the park, and then laugh about it and say, oh yeah, this is the third time I've kept a million people from seeing a wolf. Ha, ha, ha. I mean, this is what's happening. And it's very painful. There's been, in Fairbanks alone, we've had probably six or eight news stories about this. There's been protests. There was over 50 people last February at the Board of Game protesting. People hate this. They hate it. I don't know if you guys remember, I think it was about 2 years ago, there was that lion, Cecil the Lion, was lured out of a park in Africa and gunned down. That was the number one story in the world for 2 days. Universal outrage. People hate that. And frankly, that is what we're doing here. We're allowing people to bait these iconic animals out of the park. So I just feel like, come on, are you kidding me? We're going to continue to allow this?
John, can I ask you, we are going to have to, we do have at least one person from Fairbanks online. And
you bet. That's my pitch.
Anyone have any questions? None. Thank you for your testimony. Let's go to Fairbanks, and that's Al Barrett. Are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Thank you. Would you like to proceed with your testimony? And I'm hoping people can do these fairly quickly, so because we are going to have to get through here. But go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Al Barrett. I reside in Fairbanks, and I'm representing myself today. First of all, I'd like to point out what I hope is an error in the bill, an oversight. On page 2, line 20, section C, it says a person who violates A of this section is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor punishable as proven in AS 1255. Having that in law, in statute, would trump the Board of Games regulation on incidental catches. Because they're still going to allow, this bill still allows the trapping of other fur bearers. If I was trapping, and I don't trap in that area, if I was trapping in that area for lynx or wolverine or coyotes or any other animal that I set a trap on the ground for, I have the potential of catching a wolf in any one of my sets. And if I caught one, I would automatically be charged with a Class A misdemeanor violation. Not because I intentionally set for a wolf, but because I incidentally caught one in my trap. So that should be amended and fixed if this bill was to move forward. The second thing, I'd give some clarity on some comments made. The sponsor of the bill, you know, had a comment on a letter that I wrote him, which was absolutely correct. What wasn't added in that comment was, I compared it to my proposals that I write to the Board of Game or I authored for the Fairbanks Advisory Committee. And it would seem that my statistics or my passage of my proposals or my AC's proposals are no better than the non-consumptive users. And I've wrote many, many, many proposals to the Board of Game in the last 17 years. Secondly, I was on the Board of Game in 2010, and I voted to close that area. I voted on that based on the subsistence law that's in statute that the legislature had passed. And that law said that if there wasn't a biological concern, and there was trapping and there was wolves to be harvested, that we could harvest them. If there was a shortage of wolves, we'd have to go through our Tier 1, Tier 2 process of eliminating lesser users and giving the priority to the subsistence people that are in that area. And I know that I've heard most of you, all of you, say that you support state subsistence. This is a subsistence activity in that area. Those wolves have a positive C&T finding. They have an ANS, which is not necessary for subsistence. And so this bill would affect, and it is a few individuals that have those subsistence opportunities provided through the Constitution and law to partake in that. And I think that law and that Constitution protects those individuals as much as it protects the other users, including the non-consumptive users. And you can't base it on numbers of, you know, 3 or 4 trappers versus 70,000 people. It's a law backed by the Constitution that subsistence people do have some rights. The other issue I have is, you know, this is in a stampede area. You know, this is a dangerous area. On average, there's at least one search and rescue operation every year for retrieving persons or people or persons visiting the area at a great cost to the state. There's also been many deaths in this area from people visiting. I don't know why we want to create a special use area and encourage people to visit there when the terrain and the terrain features that are out there are very dangerous to people that don't know how to use that area or traverse it. The economics that we've been talking about, it's been very clear and the statistics show it that the park has been increasing in volume of visitors every year. 6 out of the last 10 years, it's been record number of people visiting the park. And it's not all because of the wolves or not because of the wolves. Gleeter Gulch is just growing by leaps and bounds. Tens of millions of dollars have been invested by private companies and private individuals to capitalize on the tourism that's booming down there. And I'll leave that for right now because you're short on time, Mr. Chairman, but I could answer any questions.
Thank you, and we do have your letter in the packet here as well, Mr. Brett. Are there any questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to make sure I have it correct, Al. So you're saying that on page 3, lines 20 and 21, that you believe that the interpretation would be as if you were hunting for something else and you somehow end up with a wolf, then you would be charged with a misdemeanor, even though you could show that that was not your intent.
The Chair, Representative Wilson, this is not hunting. Hunting, you can usually identify what you're shooting at. This is trapping. I lay a number 4 long spring on the ground for a lynx, and a wolf steps in it, which it will hold a wolf. I've caught many wolves in number 4 long springs. I would then be in violation. I'd be susceptible to a Class A misdemeanor violation. But the Department of Public Safety is online, and he could clarify that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Further questions, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Just a comment to build off something that Mr. Barrett said. This is the area west of Healy is where the bus is, the famous bus. And there's always people going out there that should never go out there.
To the Chair, is that a question?
No, it's an observation.
It's not. So I don't see any further questions, so thank you very much for your testimony. We have Tim Leskmer in Anchorage, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced the name. Would you put yourself on the record and go ahead with your short testimony, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Can you hear me?
We can. Yes, we can hear you fine.
Well, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak, and thank you, House Finance Committee, as well. My name's Tim Lesher. I'm here on behalf of myself. I work with gray wolves. I take care of gray wolves as well as moose and caribou at the zoo here in town, so I like to think I'm unbiased. You know, I probably spend more time around wolves than 99% of the population. And so that doesn't mean that I think I know more than anybody. In fact, these are animals that the more you work with them, the more questions you have. But what I think gets lost is, you know, sometimes throw out these numbers and rightly so, we're interested in the population numbers. But what gets lost is the intelligence of these animals and the sentient nature of these animals. So I'll make it quick. I just want to, I know that sounds maybe a little bit anthropomorphic, but if you meet these animals up close and personal and you work with them every day as I do, then that really comes across. So I'd just like to invite all the representatives there to come visit the zoo, and I would be glad to give you a behind-the-scenes tour with the wolves so that you can meet them up close and personal and see what I see. And, that's something that I would obviously do free of charge as well. And I also would like to applaud Representative Josephson on his recognition that this is an important thing that Alaska needs to have. And so I just wanted to comment in support of HB 105. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling in. And does anyone have any questions? Seeing none, thank you. And do we have anyone else online to testify? Do we have anybody in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony on the bill. And at this time, we have House Bill 105. There was a question, so for the sponsor, on looking at page 3, lines 20 and 21. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to ask you to, we're going to set the bill aside and pick it up later, but would you, there were comments on that as far as subsistence law and those constitutional questions, and would you come back and address those for the committee at our next hearing?
Yes, I will.
Okay, thanks. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, at our next hearing, could we also have the department on their fiscal note that's indeterminate? It was done by mining land and water, but it just talks about some of the plans that will have to be changed if this were to pass, management plans and land management regulations, and it'd be nice to know more specifically what that is and for them to come prepared for those questions.
Mr. Chairman.
And we do have, before we go to there, I do want to remind people that we do have the Director of Division of Wildlife Conservation and Wildlife Troopers online. So if anybody wants to ask either one of them a question, we could do that. Representative Joseph?
Through the chair, if I could just respond just to the last question. I believe the fiscal note that was referred to relates to the first draft of the bill, which did create a special management area. Mr. Barrett talked about a special management area. This bill does not create a special management area, the bill before you. It is a closure. That's it. That's the bill. It's a closure. And I think that I believe that it reflects a zero fiscal note.
We have three. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson.
We have three fiscal notes, and maybe some of them are old fiscal notes and have not. I have. They're all dated. Published date 3/22, 207, 208 on the bottom. So maybe we just don't have a updated one at this point.
Are we? What came to the committee, I believe, was the resources version U. Is that the...
That's the version before
that's
you.
That's the version before us.
Yeah.
Okay, and let's see. I'm trying to figure out on...
Well, maybe at the next hearing we could just make sure that we have the correct ones.
We'll want to make sure that we have updated fiscal notes if they need to be updated. And the Division of Wildlife Conservation is offline, but the troopers are there. Does anybody have a question for the troopers? Representative Guerra, you have a question for the sponsor?
It's probably trooper? Both, whoever can answer it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a question on the misdemeanor, and so I know that as a fisherman, there used to be this odd ruling on the regulation on the Kenai River, which was in October you could fish for a rainbow trout with an artificial egg, but you couldn't fish for dollies with an artificial egg, and they both fish bite the same thing, right? And so everybody said they were fishing for dollies because that was open, but rainbows weren't. Nobody ever got charged because, you know, I mean, how can you prove what they were fishing for? So the question come up for Mr. Barrett, what if he's trapping for coyote and not wolves, and a wolf is caught. The misdemeanor hunting and trapping is prohibited. Does that come with a knowing standard, an intentional standard? Do we know? Is that something we have to look at?
And I'm glad you're raising that, but I want to put it off to the next time we bring the bill up.
Okay.
Because we want to make sure that we get that right, and we also want to know about the interaction with constitutional language and other statutes. So
that's fine.
But I appreciate that. Is there anything that anyone else wants to bring up with the sponsor to have him come back the next time if it's taken up? Seeing none, thank you for coming in today. And we're going to put this aside at this time. And please get any amendments into the co-chair's office by Thursday, May 6th at 5 p.m. That's next Thursday at 5 p.m. Amendments will be due. And if the sponsor has some issues that he needs to work on an amendment with any of the members. You can work with on that. And Representative Ortiz?
Speaking about amendments, did we say anything about SB 78 and amendments being due on that?
On 78?
I think we read anything on that.
Okay. No, we didn't have. Or let's see, on 78, yes, they wanted to get amendments in by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 6th as well.
Good question. And we'll
bring, we may bring that back up under bills previously heard.
Okay.
Anything else? People want to stay around for a while?
Nope.
Okay, we'll be.
Yeah, but not
we'll
here.
Adjourned at, oops, wait a minute, I forgot to announce the next meeting. Our next regularly scheduled finance meeting will be at 1:30 on Monday, May 1st. At that meeting, we will be taking, having testimony on economic and fiscal policy overviews by Nyan Kaplan, President and CEO of Rasmussen Foundation, and Carl Davis from the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy. We'll also be having our first hearing on SB 6, Industrial Hemp Production licenses, and the committee, I think, is all aware that next week we're going to be focusing on general policies about fiscal impacts, fiscal plans, and the impacts on the economy. And we'll be having throughout that week members of industry and presentations on fiscal modeling and all at that time. So it is 5:07 and we are at in recess.